In our first presentation for Chapter 10 on bond yields and pricing, we learned how to calculate the yield to maturity, yield to call, current yield, and the yield to maturity and yield to call are basically approximations. In this chapter, we're going to get more precise. And we'll see something that should look familiar to you. But first, let's discuss yield spreads and the yield curve and what they can tell us. So let's get started on slide number 20. Yield spreads. Do you remember the spread between the ask and the bid price back in chapter 5 with stocks? Well, spreads in the bond world refer to interest rate differences. Yield spreads are the differences in interest rates that exist among various sectors of the bond market. And in general, as we'll discuss, the shorter the maturity, the lower the rate. The longer the maturity, the higher the rate. And this makes good sense after we dissect it a bit. We'll also see that the higher the rating of the bond, the lower the interest rate. And, of course, the lower the rating of the bond, the lower the higher the interest rate. And this is similar to your credit score. An individual has to have a credit score once you join the benevolent machine. And as we discussed in the previous chapter, bonds have the same, not the exact same scoring system, but they have this very similar system of determining who has the best rating, who has the worst ratings. And as we go down as we discussed in the previous presentation, treasuries carry the lowest rates because the government, the United States government, will pay its debts, folks. Don't let any fire-breathing politician trying to grab your vote tell you that the United States is going to go bankrupt. It's not. We hope. But muni bonds are next. Those, and we find that general obligation bonds have a lower interest rate than revenue bonds in general because the general obligations bonds must be paid no matter what, or the revenue bonds are paid as long as the revenue is coming in. And then corporate bonds, of course, yield the highest rates because they are more easily go into bankruptcy. Non-callable are going to have better, less rates than callable. Why? Because a non-callable bond is much more advantageous to the bond holder. Slide number 21. You may not be able to see this if you're looking on your mobile device, but there's a link that lets you go to the composite bond rates on Yahoo. And as I said, in the discussion on the assignment, and I said before, I have less and less confidence in Yahoo's website as we go forward into the future. So take these as you will. Maybe you want to find another source. But as of April 2nd, here were the yield spreads. And we see, and if you can't see it, I'll just read it out to you. The three-month treasury bills from Chapter 1, short-term investments, are paying nothing. Well, it's probably because it's rounded to two zeros, to two decimal places. Maybe it's paying 0.003 or whatever, but you're putting your money into an instrument that's not going to give you anything for 3 months. Okay, that's what people are willing to pay. The 6 month is 0.07. The 2 year treasury, 0.53. The 3 year, 0.86. The 5 year, 1.35. The 10 year, 1.91. And the 30 year, 2.54. People are locking their money away for 30 years for 2.5%. If inflation stays around 3%, which is what it's been over the last 30 some odd years, there's no guarantee that it'll stay that way, They are locking in a loss for 30 years. Okay, that's their money. They can do whatever they want with it. But look at what the corporate bonds are paying. The two-year is paying 1% to your A-rated bonds. So that's not a whole lot bigger than what the two-year treasury is paying, 0.53%. The spread is very small. The 10-year is we're not even looking at AAA. Look at just A. By the way, AAA rated, I don't know how many, there's not that many companies that are still rated AAA. The United States government isn't even rated AAA anymore, but that's a joke. That was just, that was really stupid. It should be rated quadruple A, Warren Buffett says, not just me. But 2.92, again, they're locking in 10 years under 3%. And then the 20-year A-rated bond is 3.75. Whew, bond prices are really high. Well, how do we know? Because interest rates are really low. Now, there are some people who are saying, don't worry, rates are going to go even lower because the economy is so weak. You know, they may be right, but eventually they have to go up, right? I mean, think about it. We don't want the economy this weak forever. Well, there are some people who are saying the rates are going to go up, but not because the economy is getting stronger, because of how much we have been spending, deficit spending, and also what's been happening with the Federal Reserve, where they have been buying bonds, the Federal Bank, and there's a lot of controversy over this, folks, and we're not going to wade into that controversy. But this is unprecedented, what's happened in modern history. And I am not one of those who is predicting gloom and doom, but I understand where those people are coming from. This could end very, very badly. But what they don't understand, or maybe they are poo-pooing, is that they're saying, well, the Fed's got to eventually sell those bonds. No, they don't. No, they don't. They can hang on to them and let them mature. And if they do, and if things don't fall down the porcelain oasis and bonds become basically worthless because inflation gets out of control, which it doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon, folks. The biggest component of inflation is wages. Then if that doesn't happen, and essentially the interest rates run away from them, run away, you know, we have hyperinflation and people are carrying barrels of money to the grocery store like they did in the Weimar Republic after World War I in Germany, then those bonds that the Federal Reserve holds simply disappear because the interest payments are made, and then the maturity, the principal payments are made. And when you give money to the Federal Reserve Bank, it literally drains out of the economy. People don't really understand the workings of the Fed, especially a lot of Republicans, just a lot of politicians who use the Federal Reserve Bank as a punching bag. And, you know, nothing's perfect, folks. That's the truth. But I'd like to see what they, you know, some of the ideas that they have for replacing the Fed. I just think, no, you guys want to go back to the dark ages. But that's the politics, folks. And remember what we said about politics? Poly means many, and ticks are blood-sucking insects. Slide number 22. Continuing on our discussion of yield spreads. My apologies if I'm getting a little bit off topic, but it's not off topic. The Fed and the Treasury are very important to the bond market. Often, investors will speak about the bond spreads as being tight or wide. A tight spread means the interest rates among the bonds they are evaluating are very close to one another. Let's say Treasury's paying 4.8. Yes, there was a time, not that long ago, when Treasuries were paying almost 5%, and a corporate bond might be paying 5.1%. Well, that's a very tight spread. Well, we saw a tight spread in the previous slide. 0.5 for the 2-year and 1 for A-rated bonds. It was even lower for AAA-rated bonds. Widespread means there's a big difference between the bond interest rates. Treasury's paying 3.2, corporate bond paying 8.2. That's a huge spread, a 5 percentage. And what you'll hear are basis points. Well, every basis point is 0.01%. So that would be almost, well, that would be 500 basis points, which you just divide by 100 and you get 5%. For several years throughout the 2000s, bond yield spreads were very tight. And then during the turmoil of 2008-09, the yield spreads widened to levels not seen since the Depression. Why? Because people fled to quality. It's called a flight to quality. And they ran to treasuries and dumped everything else. And we know the price goes down, the interest rates goes up. And as you saw in the presentation in Chapter 9, right, we saw the yields on the Ford bonds and the Poway bonds skyrocket because people dumped the bonds and the price went down. And then we saw those prices firm and the yields come down. And as we've seen in the previous slide, they have narrowed significantly over the past few years. Will it all end in tears? I certainly hope not, but I believe that people buying bonds right now are setting themselves up for very low returns for many years to come. And there are others who say, well, you're just a stock, you're just pumping up stocks. I don't know. I mean, maybe I am, but I'd rather own a stock that's paying 3% than a bond that's paying 1.5% or 1%. That's just my, but I'm willing to put up with the volatility, right? Whereas bond investors in general don't want volatility, but interest rates go up. What happens to bond prices? Right, so there's some people who are going to be in for a rude surprise. But does that necessarily mean they should sell? Of course not. Bond prices are going to go down when interest rates go up. When? We don't know when. Might be next week. It might be next year. Might be next decade. We don't know when it's going to happen. But if you extend your time horizon, then you can say, well, no, this is good. Higher interest rates are great for bonds because I'm getting a with my new money, I'm getting better interest rates. We'll discuss this a little bit later. Let's get going on slide number 23. And this slide is a little incoherent. It's from your book. But the idea is it's trying to show you what happens as inflation goes up. The blue is the inflation rate, and the red is the bond rates. And we see that as inflation went up, interest rates spiked. And as inflation went down, I'm sorry, the red is the inflation. What did I say? The red is the inflation and the blue is the interest rate. I apologize. Yeah, because it went negative in 2009. The inflation rate, the CPI, actually went negative because of housing crumbling and wages crumbling. And so we see that the inflation going up drove bond rates up, and then inflation dove in the mid-80s, early to mid-80s, when the Federal Reserve Bank broke the back of inflation under Paul Volcker, and down came the interest rates until finally now we're looking at very low interest rates. And this, I assume, is the 10-year 10-year treasury bond, and you see it's a little bit above 2%, but it's been below 2% now for a little while. Slide number 24, the yield curve. This is a graph that represents the relationship between a bond's maturity and its yield at a given point in time. It's also used to make comparisons among types of bonds. Now, normally the yield curve is upward sloping. Longer-term bonds have higher interest rates than shorter-term bonds and treasury bills and notes. But sometimes the yield curve is downward sloping. It's called an inverted yield curve. Shorter-term bonds shorter-term bills, notes, treasury bills, have higher interest rates than longer-term bonds. It's unusual, but it does happen. Slide number 25. Here is a... Whoops. Let's try that again. Slide number 25. Here is a graph from your book that shows just two examples. A downward-sloping inverted curve, which is the unusual one. You don't normally see this. What we normally see and what we see today, we'll take a look at it in a bit, is an upward sloping curve. Lower, these are the term and maturity, lower interest rates for instruments, bonds, notes, bills, treasury bills, corporate paper that will mature soon, and it goes higher as the maturity date goes out until, you know, it levels off after about 30 years or so. So let's take a look at the current yield curve. And here it is, folks. The three-month Treasury bill is paying you 0%. It's paying you nothing. You might as well put your money under the mattress. No, don't do that. That's not smart. But so, seriously. And then as you go out the yield curve, you see interest rates go up. And this is what we normally see. And this is the 30-year Treasury paying 2.5%. Okay, let's discuss this. We said at the beginning of the presentation that this makes sense. Why do longer-term debt securities normally have higher interest rates than shorter-term debt securities? Well, when you think about it from an investor's point of view, it just makes perfect sense. If you're going to lend your money out for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, the longer you're going to lend your money out, the more opportunities for things to go wrong. And we discussed this when we discussed the seesaw. Right, exactly. And so the academics have created these hypotheses, the expectations hypothesis, which is the shape of the yield curve reflects investors' expectations of future interest rates. Well, now this is interesting. Hang on to that one when we get back to the inverted yield curve. And the maturity preference hypothesis, or called the liquidity preference hypothesis, that investors tend to prefer the liquidity of short-term securities and therefore require a premium to invest in long-term securities. Well, this is just a fancy way of saying there's more of a chance for things to go wrong. So yeah, I want a better interest rate. I'm going to lend you my money for 10 or 20 or 30 years. And then the market segmentation hypothesis, which is the market for debt is segmented on the basis of maturity. There's a supply and demand curve within each segment determining the prevailing interest rate. So you students of economics will understand that basically what this thing is doing is breaking up 2-year, 5-year, 10-year, 3-month, 20-year, into their own little supply and demand markets. And each of these three theories makes sense, and each has its merit. But how do we account for the times when the yield curve is inverted? What factors could cause a inverted yield curve to occur? And what can the yield curve tell us about the future of the economy? Well, dear students, slide 29. Since World War II, every time the yield curve has inverted, where short-term rates were higher than long-term rates, the economy has fallen into a recession. Every time. So look to the bond market, because the bond market, you know, the stock market gets all the press, all the sexy accolades, but the bond market's far more important. There was one exception. In 1966, the economy almost fell into recession. It just hit zero and it didn't go negative. And so the curve inverted and foretold a recession, but it didn't happen. It almost happened. And right now, the yield curve is currently mostly upward, as we saw a few slides ago. But for about 2 years, before the beginning of 2008, the yield curve had been inverted. Now, it was a slight inversion. It looked like a not so much an inverted yield curve as a little a very slight boomerang. It was inverted, but barely. And for 2 years, the bond market had been predicting a recession. And the stock market didn't believe them. You know, it wasn't until the fall of 2008, you know, 8-9 months after it had finally happened, that the officials charged with tracking the economy acknowledged that we were in a recession. It took over 2 years, but the bond ghouls were finally proven right. Now, why are they called bond ghouls? Well, that doesn't mean people who invest in bonds are ghouls, but they love it when interest rates fall. Why? Because bond prices go up, right? And when do interest rates usually fall? When we hit a recession. Because there is less demand for money, so there's not as many people going out and borrowing, because there's not as many people... There are not as many opportunities for these people to use that money. We're falling into a recession. And often the government or the Federal Reserve, they will pump liquidity, meaning they will go out there and buy them, driving the interest rates even lower because they want to get the economy kickstarted. So often bond investors are called ghouls because they're applauding a recession. Well, no, I don't think they're really applauding a recession. They're applauding the fact that interest rates have fallen and their investments have gone up. So that's that. Okay? Make sense? Oh, by the way, gold bugs. People who like gold are often called gold bugs. Slide number 30. That's just the after note. Slide number 30, bond pricing. Okay. Now, we said that bonds are boring, and they are, but here's something that's actually kind of exciting, and it should look fairly familiar. Slide number 30, we see that bonds are normally priced according to the present value of their future cash flows. You see, we're going to get semi-annual interest payments, and we're going to get a repayment of the principal. So we're going to get, for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, interest payments, and they come every 6 months, but we're not going to worry too much about that. And then at the end of the term, 5 years, 10 years, 30, 2 years, whatever, we get our money back. We get our principal. Although other factors will always need to be considered, such as the creditworthiness of the issuer. Because if the bond issuer, the corporation, the municipality, not the federal government, runs into trouble, the price of their outstanding bonds will fall because investors will be afraid of default and they will dump the bonds. That's what happened to Ford in the previous chapter. You looked at the Ford bonds and you saw that they, at the depth of the Great Recession, they were priced at 60% on the dollar, 40% discount, and then have since doubled in price, some of them or more. Yeah. So here is the formula on slide 31. The bond price is equal to the expected bond price, we should say, the present value of the interest income plus the present value of the repayment of the principal. Does that look familiar? Well, it's really the discounted cash flow model. In the discounted cash flow model in Chapter 6 for stocks, we use the present value of the dividend income, because stocks pay dividends. And then we use the expected price of the stock after 3-4 years as our repayment. But bonds, we know how much we're going to get paid, right? We don't know what's going to happen with stocks. I mean, we guess, or we look at Value Line or some other entity that is supposedly smarter than we are. But in the case of bonds, assuming the bond issuer doesn't default, which is rare but does happen, we're going to get that $1,000. And then we really should use semi-annual compounding. And of course, we do in the spreadsheet. The spreadsheet can do it lickety-split, But we're just going to use annual compounding because it's easier to compute manually, which is what most of us are doing. And it gives us almost the exact same answer. And then you got to throw some slop in just because of buyers and sellers, picadillos on any one given day. And as it says at the bottom, the computations are easily done using the present value tables, and the spreadsheets make it even easier. So you're going to want to get that present value tables, too. There's two of them in Chapter 10. The one is the same as the one we did in Chapter 6, but that's on the right-hand side. We'll take a look at that in just a minute. And then there's a spreadsheet on the website and a little presentation for, there will be, it's not there yet, but it will be there, for that spreadsheet. So check, of course, in the face-to-face we would show that in class, but I'll show that in a separate little presentation for you. So let's take a look at an example on slide 32. Here we are. Avery Dennison Corporation. You ever hear of them? Yeah, sure you have if you've ever worked in an office. They make all those little labels and sticky things. Yeah, right. And so I just happened to go out there on, I used FINRA, and looked for some bonds. And here was a bond from Avery Dennison that was due in 5 years, April 15th, 2020. And the coupon was 5.375, 5 3/8. But it's priced to yield 2.927. What does that mean? Well, it's selling at a premium. You should understand that if the price is up, right, the interest rates are going to go down. And so the current yield, if you calculate it using the formula we learned about in the previous chapter, you'll see is 4.827. Now, the reason I chose this is because it's close to 3% and it's 5 years. And so what we're going to do is we're going to use 3%, which, already skews us off a little bit, but this is close enough. And so, as we said, the formula is calculate the present value of the interest income plus calculate the present value of the repayment. So now, the way we did it in Chapter 6 was to look at each individual year, because we saw that in some companies the dividends were increasing. Exactly. But in the case of fixed income securities, that's a fancy word for bonds, is the interest payment increasing? No, it stays the same. Bonds are fixed. So we get to use the table that's on the left-hand side. Now, I'm going to call it up in a bit. Hang on a minute. Let's go find it. Here it is. And so here is just the table on the left-hand side. And when we go across to 3% and down to 5 years, and we say that here is the multiplier right there, 4.580. So you see that? Okay, so let's go back. What did we do with that? Well, if it's a 5.375% bond, that means we're going to get $53.73. Is this starting to make sense? No pun intended, folks. So we're going to get $53.75, and we're going to get that 5 years, for 5 years. So how do we discount that stream of income? We multiply it by that 4.580. And that's equal to $246.20. So the stream of income that we're going to get from this bond is equal, today, is equal to $246.20. If you multiply 53.75 times 5, that's the actual amount of dollars we're going to get. But we have to discount it back to the present. Is that verb still making you feel uncomfortable? Discounting, that's what's used in the industry, folks, so get used to it. We're bringing it from the future to back to today and asking ourselves what we'll be willing to pay for that. And then we know, unlike the Chapter 6 where we were guessing what the stock price was going to be, we know we're going to get $1,000 back. Avery Dennison has been around for decades, and every office needs to have its little, right, exactly. Exactly. So now, what do we do with that $1,000? Well, let's go back to the table, and that's a single payment. So we use the table on the right. Now, this is the exact same table we used in Chapter 6, folks. The exact same table, because these are single payments. Whereas the table on the left were multiple payments over 5, 10, 20 years. So we're going to have a single payment of $1,000. So we go across the 3%, down to 5 years, and there it is. 0.863 is our present value multiplier. So we go back to the presentation, and we see we take that $1,000 and multiply it times 0.863. Oops, there's a bug here. I put the wrong number. I'll fix that. I got the right answer here, but I forgot to. I goofed up here playing with the other numbers. That should be 863. You can do that in your head, right? $1,000 times 0.863 is 863. So just imagine. It'll be fixed by the time you look at this. By the time this is up on the web, I'll have fixed that, folks. But if you add those two numbers together, you get $1,109.18. So our model, the discounted cash flow model, the bond model, is telling us the bond should be worth about $1,109. Well, on April 2nd, on the FINRA website, which I think is really Morningstar, I'm not quite sure, the bond was selling for $1,113.49, which is pretty darn close. But if we use the bond calculator spreadsheet, which is much more accurate than our little approximation here that we did on a calculator, the spreadsheet tells us it should be worth $1,103.02. And then if we use semi-annual payments, which we really should use, we get $1,114.68. Which they're all very close to one another. Now, why is the semi-annual payments prediction a bit higher? Why is the? I have two things I have to correct on this slide. Excuse me. That's it from the Department of Redundancy Department. Why is the semi-annual payments prediction is a bit higher? I tell you guys, repeatedly, you know, be careful because one typo on your resume, exactly. So I should listen up. Yeah, I got to do a better job here. Why is the semi-annual payments prediction a bit higher? Well, it actually makes sense when you think about it. We're really not waiting until the end of the year till we get to $53.75. What they're doing is they're sending half of that to us at 6 months, and then sending the other half after the year is over. So we're getting some of the money a little bit sooner, and therefore it's worth more to us today. Now you're thinking, well, we didn't do that with the dividends. The dividends are paid quarterly. Right, we didn't do it with the dividends, because first of all, it would make life a whole lot harder. And secondly, we're blowing smoke. We're throwing mirrors around and just watching which way the wind blows. And as we said, we want to alleviate, we want to remove any impression or any pretense of precision. But with bonds, it makes sense to be more precise because they are fixed. We know, barring any default on the bonds in the interest payments or the principal repayment, we know what we're going to get. So it makes sense for us to do a very precise calculation. And so why is the price about a buck less than what the semi-annual payments prediction says it is? Vagaries of the market. Plus, this bond is rated BBB, which is still investment grade, but just barely, right? Exactly. So people are going to knock a dollar off because it's not an A bond or a double A or a triple A bond. Now, let's discuss something that we hinted at. By the way, let's go back. I apologize. I'm not on my best game today, as you can ascertain. So now, in the face-to-face class, we would take a look at the spreadsheet. So I want you to take a look at the spreadsheet. And then we would do the worksheet problems, which there are, you know, worksheet problems out on the website. And then there's a commentary and an answer key. So make sure you do these, because this is what the assignment it looks like. Plus, this is what's going to be on the exam. And we're going to see this on the next exam and then the final exam, too. So get used to it. Slide number 33. So now, I continue. We made reference to a certain situation where interest rates rise that at first seemed, you know, dangerous to bondholders, because if interest rates rise, bond prices go down. But if we extend our time horizon, it's not the end of the world, folks. In fact, that can be good. Because when we invest in bonds, we have what is called reinvestment risk. That's the uncertainty about the future value of an investor's bond investments that results from the need to reinvest bond interest payments and redemptions, principal repayments, at yields that are not known in advance. So in other words, if you're not living off the income of your bonds, you're using bonds to build your portfolio, as interest payments come due, you got to do something with these things, right? Unless you're using them to buy milk and rent and cars or whatever, you got to turn around and reinvest these things. And the same thing is true for the principal repayment. So changing interest rates, as we read in the bottom, don't only affect the prices of your bonds, they also affect your future income, as you need to reinvest the interest income and bond repayments. If interest rates have fallen, sure, your bond is worth more, congratulations, but now your income level will fall as you reinvest your income and bond repayments. Likewise, vice versa. If interest rates have risen, sure, your bonds have fallen, but your future income level will rise now because you're reinvesting those interest payments and those principal repayments at higher interest rates. So we may have given you the impression that, if interest rates go up, it's the end of the world for bonds. No, it's not the end of the world for bonds. It's just a different phase of the market, and markets go through cycles, and we learn to live with them, and we learn the advantages and disadvantages, and we roll with the punches, and if the world ends, it doesn't matter. Slide number 34. Duration. Now here's where it gets a little, the term I've heard many people use is wonky. This is what you would learn about in an upper division class or a graduate level class. You'd learn how to compute duration. You just go look it up, folks. But this is a measure of a bond price's sensitivity to changes in interest rates and bond yields. It captures both the price and the reinvestment risk. So it's used to indicate how a bond will react in different interest rate environments. The duration of a bond changes as it approaches its maturity date. Well, that makes perfect sense. That's what duration means, you know, time. But it also changes as interest rates change. And in general, the longer the bond's maturity, the longer the duration, the higher a bond's nominal rate and yield to maturity, the shorter its duration. And the shorter the duration, the less potential price volatility, and vice versa. So what you're saying is I'm adding a layer of information here that tells me how much volatility my bond is going to possibly experience. And what happens then is you immunize yourself. Huh? I think it's a little silly. But see, it for most people, this is not that important because they don't have unless you're lucky enough to have a huge bond portfolio. Most of us don't have that. But If you have a specified time horizon, you can use this technique called bond immunization. We're not going to learn how to do this, folks. Yeah, when you go to graduate school, they'll teach you. To increase the probability of successfully achieving their desired goal. The idea is you keep your average duration of your bond investments equal to your time horizon. You would thus be more protected against interest rate induced price swings. The problem with this is it requires constant rebalancing of your bond portfolio since durations of bonds change as interest rates change and bonds get closer to maturity. So who do you think is going to use this? Right, mutual fund managers who have billions of dollars to invest, pension fund managers, and maybe some of you who have millions and billions who are not you're Southwestern, I don't think you have. But anyway, you might. Congratulations. Yeah, in other words, if you're running a short-term bond fund or a intermediate-term bond fund or a long-term bond fund, you would use these techniques to make sure that your bonds were appropriate to your mutual fund. You see? So this is something we're not going to learn how to do, but it makes sense. You're trying to keep your bonds appropriate to your time horizon. That's what it's doing. Slide 36. And we're getting towards the end, folks, and we'll spend a little bit of time on strategies. And hopefully these strategies have become evident to you as we've gone through the discussions of bonds. The income strategy is the easiest to implement. We purchase our bonds for the interest income they produce. Bonds are boring. We buy them for our interest. We know we're going to get our interest payments, except if the bond defaults, which is very unusual, but may happen. And we know we're going to get our principal repayments. The capital gain strategy is the hardest to implement because what we're doing is we're basically speculating, which we know is a fancy word for gambling. That we're speculating that interest rates will fall because we're going to then use the bonds as capital gains. We'll turn around and sell them at a higher price. We're maybe we're interested in income, but mostly we're interested in the ability to sell our bonds at a higher price. This is very difficult to do. As we said before, and we'll say it again, there are people making tremendous sums of money incorrectly predicting where interest rates will go in the short term. Can you imagine if they actually could accurately predict where interest rates go? And the total return strategy is the idea of blending the two, purchasing bonds for both the income and the possibility of capital gains. And you might see bond funds called the Total Return Bond Fund. In fact, that's the largest mutual fund in the world, the PIMCO Total Return Bond Fund. Maybe it isn't the largest anymore, but it was for several years. So, which is the one for you? You decide. All I know is speculating is not something I try to do, so. And Benjamin Graham would not approve. Okay, slide number 37. Bond laddering. Now, here's something interesting, especially if you have a ton of money. You purchase bonds with staggering maturities. Purchase some with short-term maturities, purchase some with intermediate-term, and some with long-term. Again, this is very popular with pension fund managers, mutual fund managers, because they have considerable sums of money to invest. And that's why many of us will buy a short-term bond fund, a intermediate-term bond fund, a long-term bond fund. I think it's way too much diversification. I just like a for people who want bonds, unless they really, really do need very, very short-term, and they want to get better than what a money market will pay them, you just buy a general purpose bond fund and run by good managers who are able to diversify on your behalf. So what are the advantages and disadvantages? Well, the advantage is you're diversified. The disadvantage is if interest rates fall precipitously, you don't get to take advantage of that huge capital gain that you'll get on the long term. Except on your portion of long-term bonds. The short-term bonds are not going to go up that much because, remember, the seesaw. When is it a good time to ladder? when you know, well, you know what's going to happen, which is usually all the case. When is it not a good time? Well, it's not a good time if you're absolutely, positively sure that interest rates are going to fall. But then again, who do you know that's accurately predicted the short-term variations in the interest rate market? I don't know anybody either. Certainly not me. Slide 38. Here's an example of investment laddering of your bonds. And this is basically the yield curve that we looked at a little while ago. You buy some things paying nothing. Not me. But of course, if you need the money in, well, I do better in a CD. If you need the money in 3-6 months or so, you gotta put it here, folks. You can't roll the dice and put it in the stock market hoping it doesn't fall 20% tomorrow, because it will someday. We don't know when. It will. It'll happen. And then as we go up the ladder, I don't know about you folks, but I would, if I were a big bond investor now, which I'm not, I'd stay fairly, I'd keep my duration, my time horizon fairly short, because we gotta turn the corner soon, please. Interest rates have gotta go up. Why? Because the economy's got to improve, right? No, it doesn't have to, but I'm cautiously optimistic. How many times have you heard cautiously optimistic from investors? And that, dear students, is our discussion of bonds. I know, it's not that exciting. I apologize. But, hey, you know, bonds are reliable. But right now, as I've said over and over again, I think the next 5 to 10 years, bond investors are not going to be real happy at the end of 10 years. Maybe stock investors might be a whole lot less happier than the bond investors. Come back in 10 years and we'll see. And now we're ready to take a short jaunt into the world of preferred stocks and convertible securities, both of which you should avoid, in my humble opinion. And then we'll be ready to wrap things up, believe it or not, in Chapter 11 with asset allocation, and basically go back and tie everything that we've learned together into one little neat package. Cool. All right. So see you in our next presentation on preferred stocks and convertible securities.